Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. The recent death of Rosa Parks reminded us of the power of an individual to challenge a cruel and dehumanizing system. Andrei Sakharov is another such example. He was, in his life, a moral force in action, a living refutation of the cold-blooded repression of the Soviet state. He became a relentless obsession of Soviet authorities, who saw him as a threat, and of the KGB, who considered him domestic enemy number one. The record of his surveillance and persecution reminds us of the high cost of freedom and the debt that will forever be owed to Andrei Sakharov. My guest is Joshua Rubinstein, co-editor with Alexander Gribanov of the KGB file of Andrei Sakharov. And Josh, here it is.
Very good.
Very good indeed, and a handsome book, and a very, very important book,
Thank you.
Well, and that's deserved praise. One of the most fascinating things about this book, Josh, to me, is it reveals to me as a reader what is fundamental to the story, and that is the process in your fine introduction by which Sakharov becomes Sakharov. We go from an honored physicist and scientist to a revered dissident. Now, the question is, how does that happen?
Well, of course, this happened in stages. Sakharov was born in 1921. He was raised within the Soviet system. He was absolutely all his life a Soviet patriot. During the war, he worked on weapons research. And after the war, Stalin not simply recruited him, but dragooned him into doing weapons research on their thermonuclear bomb project, which resulted in the Soviet hydrogen bomb, which was detonated in August of 1953.
Right.
For that alone, he was the most honored Soviet scientist in his day, the youngest member of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, winner of the Hero of Socialist Labor Award three times. He had a chauffeur. He had bodyguards. His family told me when he would go on the ski slopes, he liked to ski, there was a bodyguard with him. He was not allowed to fly in an airplane.
That's right.
He had to go from Moscow to the secret installation far east from Moscow by train. He was too valuable a person. So this is a person who reached the absolute pinnacle of prestige in the Soviet system. But internally, he always had his doubts.
Yeah. But you know, that's a fascinating answer, Josh. And one of the things that it made me mindful of is, as a revered scientist, a decorated and revered scientist, he must have been disenchanted, to say the least, disappointed, angered by the Soviet use of science. I mean, there were some of his colleagues had essentially betrayed the very profession to which he dedicated himself.
Well, there were moments while Stalin was alive when he certainly understood the repression of the state. There were slave laborers at the site building the buildings where the nuclear bomb was designed.
Right.
He knew about repression in the country generally. He was working among many Jewish scientists, and Sakharov was not Jewish, but he was working among many Jewish scientists. He understood the anti-Semitism that so animated and disfigured Soviet life in the last years of Stalin's life. But nonetheless, he worked within the system. He accepted the system as it was. There was no chance to be a dissident while Stalin was alive. That would have meant immediate suicide.
You know, it's fascinating to think of a man that famous, that revered, that celebrated, who becomes, and this is his own words, a man who speaks out because he cannot remain silent.
That's right.
And by 1966, we have this distinguished figure signing petitions. By 1968, we have him writing an essay that turns out to be, in many ways, the theme of this book.
That's right.
And this essay, Josh, from Sakharov's pen is entitled Progress, Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom. Much to be said about this. Why did he write it? What's the message?
Well, first I want to emphasize, without going into detail, that there was a process between the death of Stalin and his coming out as a dissident that really marked his stages of the cross, let's call it. Keep in mind, he expressed his disquiet over nuclear radiation and nuclear testing to Khrushchev. Khrushchev personally rebuffed him. Not by letter, personally rebuffed him. But at the same time, in 1963, Sakharov played a major role in developing the nuclear test ban treaty between John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev. So even in the 60s, he was useful to the regime, and they appreciated his role. But after Khrushchev left power in 1964 and Brezhnev took over, and things became tighter again, and there was a desire to reverse de-Stalinization of Khrushchev, that Sakharov became ever more rebellious. So he writes a letter in 66. He signs appeals, quiet appeals, in defense of these political prisoners, these arrested intellectual dissidents. And in 1968, he summarizes his thinking, thinking that was reflected in the thinking of his fellow scientists. He never said, I'm thinking of this alone. I came up with these ideas.
Right.
But my thinking about progress, my thinking about how we need to work with the rest of the world, how we need democracy in our country, reflects the mood of the scientific elite. This is the result of my conversations with other physicists who are also Soviet physicists. And so he challenged the regime. He said, look, these are our problems with the environment, with foreign policy, with the legacy of Stalinism, and the only way to address them is in a democratic system.
It's that, Josh, it's that in the sense of these are the kinds of things we should improve within the Soviet Union.
That's right.
And democratize. But isn't it also we can seek rapprochement with the West?
Well, that was the other theme, that we not only need rapprochement, he talked about convergence. Now, this is
exactly
a startling idea, of course.
West and East coming together.
That's right. He wasn't suggesting that the West take on the characteristics of the Soviet state. He was saying, A, dialogue,
right.
B, cooperation, and B, from the Soviet side, greater democratization. And, of course, the regime was not open to that dialogue. Let's emphasize this. He was not a dissident in the sense that he was in the streets. He was addressing this to his own leadership. He's saying, I have my ideas. You've honored me. Let's talk.
Right. This is an important point, and one I think we should clear up right now for the benefit of everyone watching. We use the word dissident, and I think we use it absolutely correctly, as the book does. And isn't it important, Josh, for us to say he was a dissident and not a revolutionary?
Absolutely. First, he obviously believed in principle and nonviolence.
Right.
He thought that would be completely counterproductive, not simply immoral, to use violence against the regime. And secondly, at least initially, he accepted the fact that he was living in the Soviet Union. He was not asking the Soviet Union to become England or France or Switzerland or America. And I would say even in his vocabulary, which evolved, he talked about, you know, using Leninist principles, which was a way of differentiating from the harsh, brutal methods of Stalinism.
Right.
Now, by the end of his life, Sakharov understood that Lenin was no saint either, and that the genesis of all the problems began with Lenin, not simply with Stalin.
Isn't this entirely, I mean, this whole thing, it's a very human story. This is the evolution of a man's thinking, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, Sakharov wasn't born Sakharov. He was born into a family. The Soviet Union was established. He was raised in that system. He was devoted to science, but he was never indifferent to politics.
Right.
But we have to understand the system was changing, too, and that made it possible for Sakharov to become the man he was. Yeah. Stalin died. The regime adjusted. And that's what made it possible for the human rights movement to emerge. The human rights movement could never have emerged under Stalin.
But isn't this the entire genius of what Sakharov did in several ways? First of all, as a dissident, he was sort of making, or he wanted to make, his own country live up to the ideals he thought it should,
that's right,
should sustain. And secondly, and I think you just used the phrase, putting this all in the context of human rights, at a time in which the world seemed to be waking up to human rights.
That's right. Look, Sakharov was one of the forerunners here. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was only signed in 1948. The Soviets never really distributed it. And he was one of the first, and the dissidents in general were among the first who, they gave us the words gulag.
Right.
They're the ones who made the Helsinki process so real in the mid-70s. They made it possible for the Jewish emigration movement to emerge, which had a direct input on our Congress in the 1970s to begin looking at these problems through a prism of human rights, which Jimmy Carter then picks up
right.
in 1976, and he has a correspondence with Sakharov. So Sakharov is not just influencing what's going on in the Soviet Union, but he's influenced our vocabulary, and I speak as a human rights activist
Absolutely.
Myself, that he's saying there are universal documents we are referring to, not just the Soviet Constitution or the vocabulary of Marxism, which can be interpreted in a more liberal way.
Right. I should point out for our audience that Josh is also the Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International.
Yes, that's right.
And very much a human rights activist indeed. I'm going to come back to that
Great.
Also in the course of our conversation. Let's go to the official reaction to everything that we've said to this point, because this is the book's strength. The documents are here.
That's
These
right.
are the KGB documents. And let me turn to one that fascinates me, and right at the start, just to exemplify what we're talking about, Josh. As Andrei Sakharov writes that essay we've just referred
yes.
to, that groundbreaking essay, he attracts the suspicious attention of the KGB. And it seems to me, and there are many documents here, I just want to quote for a little bit from the first one, document 7. Yuri Andropov, the leader of the KGB, is focusing on this. And they seem to be extremely concerned about the influence he can have on Western opinion, the Western view of the Soviet Union. And the fact that the Soviet Union did not immediately respond to his essay really troubles them. Quoting, Peter Gross, a New York Times correspondent who specializes in Soviet affairs, in a conversation with a Soviet official, declared that the State Department experts are inclined to discern in Sakharov's essay the contours of a new orientation that is gradually gaining ground in Soviet foreign policy. I mean, that's stunning that they thought they would have that much effect.
Look, this is one of the ironies of the book. The KGB really doesn't understand what Sakharov's doing. And the way they understand it, they're explaining it in a way that further confuses the regime itself and shows their own confusion. They were afraid that because what they were picking up was because there was no immediate public denunciation of Sakharov, that therefore this memorandum coming from such a prestigious scientist would reflect internal thinking of the regime.
Right.
And so they thought they were sending the wrong signals. So they were kind of tied up in this confusion, this dilemma, because if they were to denounce him, it would give him more prominence. And they wanted to avoid that. But, George, we have to remember, the West didn't know who Sakharov was.
What I was wondering. Because this is the other side of the question. The West did not know what Sakharov was.
No, so I looked at the New York Times, their initial coverage of in the summer of 1968.
Right.
So, well, Sakharov seems to be a prominent scientist. There are rumors he was connected to the development of nuclear weapons, but it wasn't clear. He was living in secret. All his awards were given to him in secret. He had been quoted in some obscure journals, but never identified, this is the man who designed our hydrogen bomb.
That was never public knowledge. Isn't this the irony of ironies? They have such a fear of his effect, and the West was basically ignorant of who he was?
The West was ignorant. It was very gradual that the West understood who this man was.
This moves our story along, and it's a very dramatic story, because by 1975, we can't say this, can we?
No, of course not.
By 1975, Andrei Sakharov has won the Nobel Peace Prize. The Helsinki conference is going to take place.
That's right.
Human rights are going to be, in a sense, codified. There's going to be a human rights committee, watchdog committee.
That's right.
Established in Moscow, and he's very, very important. Now, doesn't all of this, this progression, raise the KGB fears of Andrei Sakharov and his effect?
Many documents in the mid-70s that are published here and elsewhere, their reaction to the Nobel Peace Prize. Keep in mind, Solzhenitsyn had been awarded the prize in literature in 1970. Mm-hmm. By 1974, after publication of Gulag Archipelago, he's expelled from the country.
Right.
They were thinking of doing something similar to Sakharov, but they couldn't send him to the West. He knew genuine state secrets, and they were afraid of doing that.
Right.
So Solzhenitsyn they'd send to the West. Sakharov, they said, let's send him to the East, meaning Siberia, some isolated place. But they couldn't touch him until 1980.
Right.
But in the meantime, the surveillance increased, and already they began denouncing him publicly. And he was associated in these denunciations with Solzhenitsyn, which they have avoided doing between 1968 and the mid-1970s.
Right.
He was never publicly touched.
Isn't it the section of the book, Josh, that's called Counterattack?
Yes.
It's where this gets most vitriolic. I'd love it if you'd give us a sense of the kind of thing that
should
be...
Sure. Well, keep in mind, the public didn't know who Sakharov was unless they listened to the Voice of America.
Right.
So they began saying that he was a traitor, that he was a renegade. And I talked to the family. They'd be vacationing on the beach, and people would be talking about this traitor Sakharov that they heard about on Soviet radio or read about in Pravda. And Sakharov was this very mild-mannered, absent professor type, very quirky personality, never dressed in a fancy way, was indifferent to material things, very much a scientist and a human rights campaigner. And it was always troubling to them that he would be depicted in this way. And then, of course, there were personal attacks. There was an incident on the eve of Elena Bonner, his wife's children, leaving the country, where we think they tried to poison a grandson or at least do something to compromise his health. And
there's another fearsome episode where two very strange and threatening men show up.
That's later, when he's already in Gorky, where he's denounced the invasion of Afghanistan, and these guys show up and claim to be Palestinians, and they threaten him, and it's very ugly.
Yeah.
And there was a police cordon outside that apartment, so obviously it was something set up by the regime.
But what we clearly have in this phase, the phase of organization, the phase of the counterattack, when the government gets seriously concerned, is a very deepening sense of the personal persecution of this man and of
that's
his
right.
family. I mean, that's
well, again, I want to emphasize how gradual this was. They did not know what to do with Sakharov. And when he first emerges as a dissident, they're really playing with kid gloves. They do not install listening devices in his apartment, bugs, for 2 years And even then, according to the documents, the KGB needed permission from the highest level of the government, the Politburo, just to put listening devices in. For you and me, George, they wouldn't need such permission, right. Okay? Secondly, Andropov constantly says we need to talk with him. We need to have a dialogue with him. Maybe that will assuage him. Maybe we'll satisfy his ego and he'll stop with these silly appeals and meeting with journalists and meeting with diplomats. So they treated him with a great deal of respect because, after all, Sakharov gave them unimaginable power. He gave them the hydrogen bomb.
Exactly.
And they never forgot
that. Isn't this, I mean, the whole, what strikes me about this, Josh, and I think your answers are bringing out beautifully, is the agony of their dilemma. You know, here is a man who intimidates them on the one hand and who they fear on the other, and how to deal with him
It was confusing to them, and you see that in the documents, that they don't know what to do. They say, well, we'll send him to the East, we'll arrest him, we'll denounce him. But, you know, it was very funny. Even during the time they were denouncing him, I found an entry in the great Soviet encyclopedia about Sakharov with his picture.
Right.
And you'd think that someone would have picked up on the phone and said, look, leave him out of this edition.
Right.
But he was still prestigious enough. And they said something, well, he's no longer doing science, which is their way of saying he's a dissident.
Mm-hmm. What they do end up doing is sending him to Gorky.
Yes.
Internal exile. Now, how do they come
well,
to that
decision?
Well, this
is obviously a very dramatic turning point in his life. In December of 1979, the Soviet Union invades Afghanistan. And at the same time, they're preparing to host the Olympics in the summer of 1980. And they have to prepare the capital, prepare everything on political grounds. Sakharov immediately denounces the invasion. And this becomes their pretext for getting him out of Moscow. So they carry out what I call an administrative kidnapping. There's no court session. There's no defense attorneys. In fact, the decree is not even signed by Brezhnev. Hmm. But they simply stop his car. He has a chauffeur-driven limousine because he was going to the Academy of Sciences. And they say, we are now sending you to Gorky.
Right.
You can call your wife. She can join you. And we're sending you to Gorky. That's the beginning and end of it. The mistake they made was that between 1980 and 1984, they allowed his wife, Elena Bonner, to travel back and forth between Moscow and Gorky, and she made well over 200 trips. So she brought appeals, she brought letters, she brought news. We know she brought drafts of his memoirs, and the regime did not stop that until 1984. So he was not as isolated as they wanted him to be.
So through her agency and her trips to Moscow, the world kept informed
of Sakharov. This was a mistake on the regime's part, which they corrected in the spring of 1984 when she was arrested. But for some reason, they allowed that, and I still don't understand why, but they did.
Josh, I've quoted from this book, but I wonder, is there a particular point you would point out as to be a characteristic of the kind of
There's
thing we're talking about here?
You know, there are almost 150 documents here in the book, and we talked about their reaction to the Nobel Prize. I just want to elaborate on that a little. One of the reviews of my book was called What Andropov Knew, that what he understood about the challenge of Sakharov and why they had to be tough on him and persecute him. And the reason is that Andropov understood that if they were to compromise, if they were to allow dissent, if they stopped arresting dissidents, that the consequences would be, as he says, unforeseen. And in the fall and winter of 1975, after Sakharov gets the Nobel Peace Prize, they're under pressure, not just from the West, but from foreign communist parties who are raising the question about human rights and prisoners, and they're feeling uncomfortable.
That's the most uncomfortable pressure of all.
And Andropov says to the Politburo, from all of this about these denunciations and dissidents we're arresting, this is what I need to tell you. It follows that a renunciation of active measures to terminate the politically harmful activities of dissidents, meaning arresting them, and other hostile elements, as the French and Italian comrades want, meaning our fellow communists, that this could be fraught with the most serious negative consequences. It is impossible to make concessions of principle on this question, since these would inevitably lead to further unacceptable demands on us. Now, why is this important, George? 10 years later, Gorbachev becomes head of the country.
Yes.
And Gorbachev makes a principal decision early in 1986 to stop arresting political activists.
And this is a beautiful connection into where I want to bring us right now. Because Gorbachev makes that connection, and it's largely inspired by the example and the narrative of Andrei Sakharov. And what I came to understand through this book is that as Gorbachev does this, you know, he's going to impose this from above,
right?
But he needs support from below.
That's right.
And this is what Sakharov offers him. And Sakharov's deal, and you correct me if I'm wrong on this,
yes,
is that for giving you support, Mikhail Gorbachev, and what you're about to do,
yes,
or undertaking, I want you to understand there can be no more prisoners of conscience.
That's right.
That's the deal.
That's right. I think this is a real tribute to Sakharov and the human rights movement, mm-hmm, that it's a matter of principle. Yes, let's have less censorship. Yes, let's have dialogue with the West and over nuclear weapons. But the bottom line is you do not arrest people for their political beliefs. Mm-hmm. And until you begin, A, releasing those that are held that you've inherited, after all, from Brezhnev, no one's blaming you for that, and B, stop arresting new political prisoners,
right,
you will have no moral integrity.
This is almost a mirror image of the first question I asked you. In this sense, Josh, Sakharov helps Gorbachev become Gorbachev.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And by the way, his death in December 1989 is a real loss for Gorbachev.
And you will use your own words. It robs Gorbachev of, quote, a partner of equal standing.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that in Russia today,
yeah,
that there's no one of moral stature to challenge Putin from within. But that's part of the story.
I want to ask you about that big time,
yes,
in a moment. But for the moment, let me ask you this. This support that Andrei Sakharov, and we're talking about the final 3 or 4 years,
that's
of his,
right,
life, that he renders to Gorbachev, and for good cause, and for finally seeing his own ideals in realized.
Right.
But it costs him, does it not?
Yes.
I mean, it seems to me this is not universally welcome among,
that's
the,
right,
dissident community.
Well, keep in mind, Gorbachev comes to power in March of 85, and initially there's nothing to indicate he's such a reformer. Okay, he looks better, he's dressed more sharply, he's not comatose like the last three guys. Okay, but that's not enough. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing Sakharov and his colleagues made clear is we set the terms for how you will be understood in the West. Mm-hmm. We set the terms. If there's censorship, if there are political dissidents in jail, you do not have legitimacy. And Gorbachev came to understand that. So when he starts releasing people, Sharansky in February of 86, Orlov in the fall of 86, then Sakharov in this dramatic move in December of 86, and then there's a public declaration, we will release all political prisoners. That comes in February of 87. This is sets the tone.
Right.
Then you don't have censorship. You have the publication of Solzhenitsyn's books, of George Orwell, of everything that we came to see. That's very exciting. Sakharov is thrilled. Other dissidents still are skeptical. And Sakharov says, look, we have to work with this guy. We're seeing what we worked for. Let's work with him. He's not a revolutionary. He doesn't expect the Soviet Union to adopt the American Constitution. He still wants to see a unitary state, by the way. Sakharov was against the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Yes, I know, yeah.
And this is very important. Mm-hmm. He was very much a gradualist. The country had experienced one experiment already and suffered for it. He didn't want any further experiments. So he got into difficulty with other dissidents.
Yeah. You know what strikes me, and this is as I suspected, because I have the pleasure of knowing you,
sure,
Josh. This is an extremely lucid explanation of a major point in history. And I think what you're telling is Sakharov was both an idealist and a realist.
Very much so.
These were his dual characteristics.
That's right. He was very pragmatic, not in a way that would compromise his principles,
mm-hmm,
but he never forgot the system in which he was dealing.
Yeah.
And he accepted that.
What happens at this point in our history with the KGB's documentation of him? I mean, is there a change in tone?
Well, there is a change in tone in that they're no longer in the driver's seat. Gorbachev's in, mm-hmm, charge. And whereas Andropov was giving directives to Brezhnev, and you see that in the documents, and he's not just informing him, but he's setting policy. By 86, the KGB is drawn back, and Gorbachev's in charge.
Right.
And they're deferring to him. Secondly, keep in mind, this is not the full documentation. This is only 146 documents based on 204 memos that Boris Yeltsin provided to the family after Sakharov's death in 1989. We know there were hundreds of other documents.
Right.
Probably thousands from the actual operatives in the field. Those were never shared. And we only have a handful of documents from the time that Sakharov returned to Moscow until his death. But still, it shows they didn't stop watching him.
Mm-hmm.
They were always nervous about what he said. They kept reporting to the political leadership, their political masters, but they treated him with more respect. Yes.
Josh, as we come to the end of Andrei Sakharov's story and near to the end of our conversation, I want to, and it's a very fascinating story. And
Thank
it's
you.
A story of our times,
sure,
really. I mean, this will never go out of relevance. There's
right.
no question about that. And I want to ask you a question about the relevance of it, Josh, as Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International. The Soviet Union we see today, under Vladimir Putin, has been accused by many of trying to refurbish the Soviet image, that there's been this celebration of symbols, if not substance, of the past. Does that give you, I guess it's a two-part question, first of all, does that give you concern about the degree to which all that we've talked about here and the legacy of Andrei Sakharov may be overrun, overturned?
You know, I think it's a very mixed picture, but a very disturbing picture coming out of Russia today. On the one hand, the borders are much more open. Mm-hmm. Putin and this new administration are not afraid of graduate students coming to the West, which we didn't see in the old days. There's the access to the internet. There's a great deal of religious freedom. Mm-hmm. I think there's a much more sophisticated crowd. They're interested in power. And they understand that these other issues, these other dimensions of Russian life can be tolerated because it really doesn't compromise their power. Mm-hmm. Secondly, they are part of Europe and they accept that, which the Soviets obviously could not accept. Mm-hmm. They understand the East European countries will remain independent. The Baltic states will remain independent. So let's understand that there's been a complete and dramatic shift away from that.
They're realists.
But what we're really concerned about is the concentration of power. And that's what Putin is consolidating. So we see pressures on nonprofits, on the NGO sector, on human rights groups, domestic human rights groups, and that's very ugly, very worrisome. We see some political prisoners starting to be taken. Mm-hmm. We see pressure on some of the more marginalized religious groups rather than a feeling of tolerance. The press is no longer really free. There was much greater press freedom under Gorbachev, under a communist regime, between 86 and 90, 91, than we see in Moscow today, frankly.
So what we have to watch is the concentration of power and the abuse of it.
Exactly. The concentration of power, the abuse of power, and the monopoly of freedom of expression and the constraints on freedom of expression. That's the canary in the mine.
Hmm. Josh Rubenstein, it's always an honor to talk with you. I always learn, and I think the lessons we've learned from this conversation and from this book are that we have to be vigilant.
George, thank you.
Thank you very much. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Joshua Rubenstein. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.